Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. Toyota on the hot seat.
After 6 miles, God intervened. With the car stopped and both feet still on the brake, the motor still revved up and down.
That's Rhonda Smith talking yesterday about her Toyota. Whether or not God intervened, Congress has intervened. Lawmakers want to know what Toyota knew and when they knew it. And yesterday, Toyota started giving answers.
We've done extensive testing on this system, and we've never found a malfunction that's caused unintended acceleration.
Lawmakers have plenty of legislating to do this week, but the real show is in the hearing rooms as Toyota executives go on trial. Today, the big boss is called to the carpet all the way from Japan. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 24th. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. He'll be back tomorrow, and I'm here with Celeste.
Good morning. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning. More now on Toyota's walk through the Capitol Hill fire pit. Here's Congressman Henry Waxman grilling Toyota's U.S. President James Lentz yesterday.
Do you believe that the recall on the carpet changes and the recall on the sticky pedal will solve the problem of sudden unintended acceleration?
Not totally.
Lentz also apologized repeatedly for the safety problems that led to the worldwide recall, saying the company lost sight of the customer.
Now that sets the stage for Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, the grandson of the company's founder, to testify before Congress today. We're joined now by Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Now, based on what you saw of the treatment that James Lentz, the North American president of sales, got yesterday in front of Congress, what kind of treatment do you think Akio Toyoda, the big boss, is going to get today?
It won't be polite and it won't be easy. In fact, Mr. Toyoda may again wonder why he did come to Washington. As you know, last week he was saying that he probably wouldn't and would let his American executives handle the mess here in the States. Well, I think he's going to be thinking that he probably should have stayed home.
Well, Paul Eisenstein, stay with us because we're going to be following those hearings and looking ahead to the hearings in just a bit, so stay with us.
Staying on Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a parliamentary shortcut called reconciliation to bypass Republicans and pass a health care bill. Republicans are complaining because the move would allow Democrats to pass the bill with just 51 votes. But Reid says,
realistically, they should stop crying about reconciliation as if it's never been done before. It's done almost every Congress.
Reid says reconciliation has been used 21 times since 1981, mostly by Republicans. In Greece this morning, police in Athens have fired tear gas on demonstrators protesting the government's austerity measures. Up to 2 million people are participating in a general strike after the government announced a wave of belt tightening to reduce a ballooning budget deficit that's affected the rest of the Eurozone. And in Haiti, the last two American missionaries still held on child kidnapping charges are expected to be freed soon.
At the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, the U.S. leads the medal count with 26, followed by Germany with 23 and Norway with 17. We'll talk more with the New York Times Olympic editor in just about 20 minutes. Moving to the markets now, Asian markets are down, European indices are mixed, and futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,292, the S&P opens at 1,094, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,213. Coming up in the show, we talk food every Wednesday. How much do expiration dates really matter, those labels on your food? They might matter a little bit less than you think, and we'll talk more about that later in the hour.
Our series, Frustration Nation, continues today. Being frustrated is one thing. We've heard you're frustrated, but do you have a solution? Some of us have been giving us answers to the gridlock. Doug in Gillette, Wyoming, posts to our site, "Stop calling Americans stupid and listen." Give us your fix at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk more about the congressional hearings about Toyota and look forward to Akio Toyota's appearance today in Congress in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillik here in for John Hockenberry. He'll be back tomorrow. Toyota is, meanwhile, answering a lot of tough questions about safety recalls this week on Capitol Hill. Today, the company's CEO, Akio Toyoda, will testify before the House Oversight Committee. Yesterday, it was Consumers' chance to speak, along with some other Toyota executives. One after the other, Toyota owners sat down and related startling experiences with their vehicles, like a tearful woman named Rhonda Smith, a driver whose car suddenly accelerated back in 2006.
After 6 miles, God intervened. As the car came very slowly to a stop, I pulled it to the left median. With the car stopped and both feet still on the brake, the motor still revved up and down.
That was Rhonda Smith, Toyota owner. Also called to the carpet yesterday was James Lentz. He is president of North American sales for Toyota. That means he's the boss in North America. And he was called on the carpet in front of the congressional committee yesterday. Paul Eisenstein from the DetroitBureau.com is back with us. Paul, James Lentz, did he provide satisfying answers on the cause of sudden accelerations in Toyotas and what might be done to fix them?
No, anything but. In fact, the testimony that Lentz provided seemed more guaranteed to keep him out of jail. As you know, there are now criminal investigations looking at Toyota than it did necessarily to save the company. What you come away with is the recognition that Toyota is essentially saying that the two recalls it has in place right now for accelerator problems will only directly address perhaps 30% or so of the complaints it's received. Now, the maker continues to insist that it doesn't have an electronics issue and that it has fully tested this. Yet we saw testimony from a Professor Gilbert of Southern Illinois University, which raises questions about that. Is he credible? We don't know. But it certainly threw into tatters the calm assertions by Mr. Lentz that they are in charge here.
But also when James Lentz was asked whether the planned fixes to software and carpets would fix acceleration problems, he said he wasn't sure.
Exactly. And that's the problem. They've been saying all along, we've all been watching television or reading the papers and seeing and hearing them calmly assert, we are in control. We have isolated the problem, and we're going to fix it. That claim, he said, one of his comments during his original testimony was, the solutions we have developed are both effective and durable. Yet by the end of the day, They appeared less durable than his own testimony. What's really scary, though, is that what we're now seeing is a company that seems enmeshed in secrecy. We've had huge problems with safety over here, and yet, according to Mr. Lentz, it appears that American officials were kept in the dark, that virtually all the key decisions were handled out of Japan. And as we heard from Ray LaHood not all that long ago, it appears that the people in Japan were very reluctant to take the steps that they needed to. They had to plead with them to do the second recall. This is not a good sign for a company that bills itself as safe and reliable and an American company.
Now, as we look forward now to the testimony of Akio Toyoda, who is the big boss coming over from Japan, based on the treatment that you saw for James Lentz yesterday, you expect the big boss, as I'm calling him, to get withering treatment or something a little more deferential?
I don't think Toyota-san will have an easy time. There are a lot of questions that were left unanswered yesterday or the answers left in tatters, and I think that the second committee, members of the second committee, they're going to smell blood from what happened yesterday and go after it vigorously.
You say smell blood, Paul Eisenstein, finally, but is there a measure of political grandstanding on Capitol Hill? It's kind of the coin of the realm, or are they really getting to the bottom of things?
Well, there's a lot of grandstanding here, but the fact is Toyota is coming across as a very vulnerable company that did not live up to its own promises. That's going to lead to grandstanding, but it's also going to lead to some serious questions.
More hearings today on Capitol Hill with Toyota. Paul Eisenstein from the DetroitBureau.com will be watching. Paul, thank you. Now we want to turn to Bill Emmett, the former editor of The Economist. He spent many years in Japan covering that country, and he knows a thing or two about Akio Toyoda, the president of Worldwide Toyota, who's going to be on Capitol Hill today. Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Bill, tell us a little bit about the man, Akio Toyoda. He'll be testifying today in front of Congress after a long flight over from Japan. Who is this man?
He is the grandson of the founder of Toyota. That is a return to family control or family leadership of the company after several CEOs who were not from the family. So it's rather like Bill Ford returning family control to Ford. He's an unusual character in that he is quite outspoken. The tradition at Toyota is that they've generally been very shy of publicity. They come from Nagoya, about an hour and a half from Tokyo, not from the capital. They tend to come across as rather provincial, shy people who don't see the point of publicity. He is very outspoken. He told a group of Japanese journalists late last year that Toyota was coming towards a crisis and that needed big changes if it was to recover. Now, this was before the recall, so I would imagine he now thinks he's really in a crisis.
And Bill Emmett, formerly from The Economist, as lawmakers read his profile and their chiefs of staff brief them about what kind of man this is, do you think after reading those profiles they choose to go at him hard as though he were the CEO of AIG, or do they treat him with deference and respect because he's come all the way from Japan?
Oh, I think they'll go after him fairly hard. Maybe a bit more deferential than with AIG or with someone from Citibank, but they will appreciate that he's come all the way from Japan. However, this is a safety issue. It's an issue of populist politics as well, and they're being lobbied probably by U.S. car makers to treat their major Japanese competitor pretty roughly. And so I think that they will give him a pretty hard time.
Bill, did you think Bill Ford has said he thinks Akio Toyota is taking this recall personally and hard? Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think he probably is. I think he is very outspoken about his company. He's very personal in his defense of it. And he genuinely thinks his company is facing a crisis. But given that they have such a reputation for quality, it really is a serious crisis for Toyota.
Well, congressional hearings like this can sometimes effectively amount to a public trial. Akio Toyota called to the carpet in Congress today, and we'll see how he's treated and how he reacts to lawmaker questioning. Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist, who spent many years in Japan. Thank you for joining us this morning. And now let's check in on some stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
The Senate is expected to pass a $35 billion jobs bill today. The bill would offer tax breaks to companies that hire new workers. It's the first of several jobs bills promised by the Democrats. Staying with jobs, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says President Obama's stimulus package created between 1 and 2 million jobs in 2009. In health care, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a shortcut to get the health care bill passed. The fast-track approach is known as reconciliation. It would allow Democrats to bypass Republican opposition.
A Colorado math teacher is being hailed as a hero after he tackled a man accused of shooting and wounding two students at a middle school. The teacher, David Benke, says he had no time to fear for his life when he tackled the man as he was preparing to reload a rifle.
I saw this guy with a gun. Unfortunately, he got another round off before I could grab him.
The man is thought to have been a former student at the school. Meanwhile, a court in Italy has convicted three executives of the internet search engine giant Google. That's after a video posted online showed a group of teenagers abusing a boy with Down syndrome. The video was posted on YouTube, which Google took over back in 2006. And at the Olympics today, the bobsled finals are on the agenda. The U.S. is in the running for a medal. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we go to Vancouver for more on the Winter Olympics. We talk with New York Times Olympics editor for an on-the-ground report that's coming up in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the stories we're following all week. First up, a monthly poll shows a sharp drop in America's consumer confidence. Louise Story, a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, what does a sharp drop in consumer confidence mean? Why did it go down so much?
Morning, Todd. You know, one thing that surprises me is that analysts were so wrong. They were expecting it to go down maybe, 1 point. It went down 11 points. And that's because all around us, people are talking about this recovery. But apparently, at least, according to this index from the Conference Board, regular people out there are just not feeling it. And this index focuses on two areas. It asks them how they think about the current environment, what things look like now, and what they expect for the future. And for both pieces, people dropped their expectations, they dropped their assessments, they said, you know, it doesn't look as good as it did the past few months.
So if people are hesitating buying that new refrigerator, buying that new washing machine, that must have implications for the broader recovery.
Absolutely, because, you know, consumer spending is about 70% of the economy. This index also asked people a lot of questions about jobs and whether they think it's easy to get jobs or not, and people said, no, it's still very hard to get jobs, and their assessments of that fell from the last few months, looking like it's a little harder for people to get jobs.
So people are skeptical about money coming in and skeptical about spending it. Louise Story, finance reporter from our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Louise.
For our next takeout, we'll go to Vancouver for an update on the Winter Olympics. Jason Stallman is the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning again, Jason.
Good morning.
Unexpected things happened last night. It was the big event. Everyone's been waiting for women's figure skating and some surprises on the ice.
Well, it's going to take a lot for me to kind of rein in the hyperbole here, because what happened in women's figure skating last night was absolutely unbelievable. I was trying to gain a reference point, and I think I had to go back to the Beijing Olympics with Usain Bolt that August night at the Bird's Nest when he ran the 100 meters in a time that completely floored everyone. And a similar thing happened last night at Pacific Coliseum with women's figure skating. The working press, at least, was left staggered, and I think the live audience was as well. Mao Asada, a Japanese figure skater who is a gold medal contender, performed flawlessly. She was in first place. The very next skater was Kim Yuna of South Korea, who is widely regarded as the best in the world, and she somehow one-upped her. It was a really spectacular performance that many people who've been around figure skating for a long time said it was the best they'd ever seen, and she set a world record. And then before anyone could catch their breath, Joanny Richet of Canada stepped onto the ice. This is 2 days after her mother died suddenly of a heart attack, and she had the best performance of her career. And now she's in position for a bronze medal. So a lot to process, needless to say.
The Americans were not expected to show well, but they performed well last night, did they not?
They did perform well. Mariah Nagasu, the very young American, she went 11th. There were 30 skaters, and she went relatively early. She had a bloody nose halfway through her routine and still finished pretty strong. And she and Rachel Flatt, the 19-year-old high school senior, they're in the running for perhaps a bronze medal. If one of the top three skaters falls or tripped up or otherwise, the Americans could come away with a bronze on Thursday night.
Okay, another big name, Bodie Miller, went to try and get his fourth medal and maybe become the first guy to get a fourth medal in alpine skiing. What happened in the giant slalom?
Well, Bodie started strong, and coming out of the gate, it was quite obvious that he was willing to take every risk he could to come away with another medal. As you mentioned, four in one Winter Olympics would be a record for alpine skiing. And he just got a little bit too audacious on the giant slalom course, and he missed a gate and couldn't regain his line. So he skied off the course. He's got one more chance. That's Saturday in the slalom to set that record.
And we'll be seeing, watching to see if he makes it. Jason, stay awake there in Vancouver. Jason Stallman, the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times.
For our last takeout now, we turn the microphone over to you, the listeners.
This is Dale Davidson from Manhattan.
Dale's one of our many listeners who reached out to us on Frustration Nation, our series on where we look at gridlock in Washington. And yesterday we asked, is the media to blame, and what's your big frustration moment?
My media frustration moment came back in the 80s. They decided to change the FCC ownership of radio stations and TV stations so that non-American citizens could own these. And I said, hello, Rupert Murdoch.
Now, Al emails us, Americans fall for spin doctors who use the media to get these voters to react, and then they blame the media. The Tea Party and healthcare are two prime examples. Voters get spun, and instead of blaming themselves for their own stupidity, they look around for the nearest target, and the media and the Congress are to blame.
Al was kind of in the minority among the respondents, though. Most listeners agreed with Anne from Massachusetts. She emails, we depend on the media to call politicians out for misstatements and lies. The healthcare reform issue is an example. We hear that most Americans are happy with their insurance. Then we hear 30 million people are without health insurance. Please clarify what this means.
There were also a few of you who thought like Cedric in Miami and thought the media is not wholly to blame. He posts on our site. Yesterday, your guest Kathleen Hall Jamieson from Annenberg Public Policy Center said,
Blaming the media for causing the problem is like blaming the family dog or the in-laws for a divorce. Small part of the problem, yes. Central to the problem, no.
Cedric doesn't like that analogy. He says it's more like this. Blaming the media for gridlock is like blaming the vindictive mother-in-law who tries to pass unverified claims as facts and profits from the strife by selling ad space on her blog. Now, of course, we cannot blame her completely, but she did not help the situation either.
And, of course, we are part of the media, and one of the criticisms we received comes from Charles on our website, thetakeaway.org. I question the entire premise with this week-long series. Is there gridlock in Washington, or is there a hard and bitter debate over an overwhelmingly huge new federal health care spending bill? Is your show trying to leave listeners with a subliminal message that if there's no passage of the Obamacare bill, then Washington is guilty of a kind of institutional pathology? The answer to that, Charles, would be no. No subliminal messages.
All right. If you want to keep sticking it to the media or to us, you can do it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment on the website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, broadband access is a top priority for the White House, but even if it reaches the hinterlands, will people be able to afford it? About a third of them can't. Is broadband internet so important that the government should pay for it? That's what we're going to be talking about in just a few minutes. Stay with us.
Coming up, does everyone in America need broadband access? And if so, can we afford to get it to them all? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. In a little more than 2 hours, Toyota President Akio Toyoda will be called onto the carpet in Capitol Hill. He's expected to apologize for safety lapses. Earlier, we spoke to the Wall Street Journal's Kate Linebaugh, who covered yesterday's Toyota hearings, and we'll be back later this morning.
Potentially, this could be in Japanese translation, which would make it a whole lot longer, and that's almost hard to imagine given how long yesterday's hearings were.
Also on Capitol Hill, the Senate's expected to hand Democrats a much sought-after victory today by passing a jobs bill. Among the provisions is a tax break to companies that hire the unemployed.
Moving overseas now, an Italian court convicted 3 Google executives of privacy violations this morning because they did not act quickly enough to pull down a video that showed bullies abusing an autistic boy. Bill Eckertson, a senior communications manager at Google, says the company will appeal.
Sites like Blogger and YouTube, if they're held responsible for vetting every video, then the freedom that we know, the web we know, will cease to exist.
The case is being closely watched around the world because of its implications for internet freedom. Here at home, major cuts are coming to ABC News. The company says it plans to lay off 25% of its editorial staff. That's about 400 people. And Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke heads to Capitol Hill today to deliver his twice-yearly economic report. Let's check in on the markets now. Asian markets are down. European indices are up. And futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,292. The S&P opens at 1,094. And the NASDAQ opens at 22.13 this morning, and those are some of the stories we're following.
Does this bring back memories for you? Listen to that. That's the sound of a computer trying to connect to the internet over a telephone line. Well, if you live in a big city, it's probably been a while since you've heard that because you probably use broadband, a cable modem, and you haven't heard that squeak of the 56K modem in quite some time. But in rural America, that's probably a much more recent memory. Only a third of web surfers have high-speed hookups. 93 million Americans have no access to broadband, and now the FCC is looking to do something about that. We're joined now by Nick Zaberla. He's on the case. He's a community activist in the city of Whitesburg, Kentucky. He started a group called Dial Up Rocks that tries to address this lack of broadband in rural communities. And we're also joined by Brian Stelter, media reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And there's an article in today's paper by Brian on yesterday's FCC announcement and the kind of nuanced stance from the Obama administration on this issue. Good morning to both of you, Brian and Nick.
Good morning.
So, Brian, you wrote about this FCC announcement yesterday, and I was really interested in the categories that the FCC made. The FCC talked about the 4 categories of people who don't have access to broadband. Can you tell us what those were?
That's right. They saw that some people were very motivated to get online. They found that some people were entirely disinterested in getting online on broadband, and they found that some people just didn't have the tools to do so, and they created clever names for each of those categories. Basically, what they're trying to do is set the table for the rollout of a national broadband plan to get more and more Americans with high-speed internet.
Okay, Nick Zabarella, let me ask you, why does it matter whether somebody has dial-up or broadband? I mean, it's a good thing that most people have access to the internet at all. Does it matter if they can't stream Hulu shows quickly?
Well, I think in rural America, it's not just wanting to download Hulu shows, but it's access to health care, students being able to do their homework, small businesses being entrepreneurial online. We see a lot of people in our community spending a great deal of time trying to get to broadband access, including a young man I have down the road from me who spends about an hour a day traveling to get to broadband access. So I think it's more about quality of life than entertainment.
Brian, the Obama administration is on board with that. They recognize that with our society, the way that our society is today and actually how necessary it has become to be able to access things over the internet, the Obama administration has made universal access a top priority. But how are they going to do this? How are they going to address the cost issues of setting up the kind of network that will get broadband to everyone?
What they're going to do, and they're going to, you know, they'll be releasing a plan in about a month that will outline a lot of these issues. But so far, what it seems they'll do is try to encourage innovation, try to encourage companies like Google that want to roll out ultra high speed access, and they will try to create a different sort of markets, test markets for this in other ways. But a lot of this is going to be trying to prod the private sector into both speeding up the existing access, the people that already have it, and then trying to reach those last miles, those rural parts of the country that don't have access yet, trying to get that there in the first place. This report found that, you know, about 12% of people that don't have broadband said that's because they couldn't get it at all. And that's going to be the hardest part.
Nick, here's the thing, though. In this FCC announcement yesterday, the thing that is surprising is that 35% of Americans don't use broadband at home, but only 4% of the people who don't have broadband want it or say that they would buy it if they had it, meaning that there are some people out there that are skeptical of the need or the cost is prohibitive of them. So how are you talking to people and actually getting to people to convince them that they need broadband?
Well, we need to think about kind of lifting all communities, and definitely if we think of children who are in those households who want an education future, we really need to think of broadband as a universal service, like we have highways, roads, electricity, and phone service, and that we can't depend on corporations or telecoms because, as here in Kentucky, they will tell you it's cost prohibitive to go that last mile. So I think we really need – I think the FCC is on the right track on providing access that's accessible, and that's including subsidies for hardware, for equipment, for people to get online.
Well, that's my next question for you, Nick. You anticipated it. What happens if that last mile is covered and then it's just that much more expensive for people? Are you confident that subsidies will be sufficient, that it'll be worth it for people to buy it, or will it just be too expensive?
I mean, I think this is it's an investment that we need to make. If you in a rural town, it really is going to come down to the economics, where you have folks who are, you know, choosing between paying for their electric bill or, you know, buying prescription medicine. We have an opportunity in this country to really raise all ships. Is that last mile going to be affordable for everyone? No. But is it something that we need to do as a society? Definitely. We have communities here where the telecom has run the broadband access within 100 yards of people's homes, but are not willing to stretch it those final feet for cost prohibition.
And Brian Stelter, did the FCC say anything about what they call the digitally distant? These are people who are around 63 years old, 10% of the population, who say they don't see what the relevance of the internet is?
This is the part that fascinates me personally. I think what the FCC has said is that if once you're online, you understand why it's important to be online. The problem is getting those people to try it in the first place, to come online and realize it's not simply a place to get viruses and to get scammed. Certainly it's possible. Certainly you need to have some sort of education.
Try it, you'll like it, right?
Having that education is going to be an important part. But once you're online, you realize those dangers are minimal. And really, that's what would sell you on it.
Brian Stelter is a media reporter for The New York Times, and Nick Zabarella is a community activist. He runs the group Dial Up Rocks, an advocacy group in Kentucky. Thanks so much to both of you. Do you dial up? Call us and tell us what that's like, if there's things that you can't do on the internet or can't access, and if you have faster connections of your broadband, could you live without your cable modem? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I for one, I mean, I could live. Let's be honest. I could live.
Even without your Facebook?
I could live without Facebook. I mean, come on. You could live without it. But there's a lot of stuff I do. Checking my son's homework. His homework is online, even. From his homework assignments from his teachers. I got to access it.
You could live without it, just not easily.
That's right.
Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry until tomorrow. Some breaking business news now about Google. Three European internet giants have complained to the European competition regulator that Google is choking competition by unfairly listing their services lower down on your search page when you search for them. One of the companies that's complaining about Google is owned by Microsoft. We're joined now by the BBC's business correspondent, Russell Padmore, live from London, to tell us more. Russell, who is complaining about Google's placement of their companies on a search page?
Well, Todd, we're talking here about three basic companies. Foundum, that's a UK price comparison website. eJustice, a French legal search engine. And Chaobing, that's effectively an Italian search engine company, which is owned by Microsoft, the company buying it fairly recently. Now, they're actually saying that Google is being a little unfair in that if you go and do a search, for example, Foundum have produced their own search of Zanussi, the Italian refrigerator company, for example, or Nokia. They did a search on the phrase Nokia 5800. If you're searching for one of Nokia's cell phone handsets, you find that Google's own services suddenly leap to the top of the search results, and their own particular company, Foundum, was well down the list. They're saying that's not right because effectively they're losing out, and Google is unfairly promoting its own products. They've asked the antitrust watchdogs in Brussels here in Europe, who run the competition regulation for the European Union, to take a look at what Google's doing, saying it's unfair competition. They're effectively promoting themselves in front of the competition.
Now, this is also about advertising, right? Because these searches get money by click-throughs. So if a company like Nokia, for instance, and I'm just using a for instance, has an advertising deal with Google and is then further up the page than a company that advertises with Foundum, it gets complicated.
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the Google page, you'll see a certain section of it is where companies are paid to put themselves at the top. Google's making money from that. You have to remember, though, as you said, that other companies can make money from online advertising simply by people coming to their site. How do they learn about you, though? They're going to go to one of these search engines, whether it's Yahoo or Google or MSN's Bing, Microsoft's Bing, and they're going to put in a key phrase and hopefully find your company at the top. And then based on that, if you are like Foundum, for example, you're a price comparison website, well, the amount of clicks to your website is how you earn money in advertising revenue based on how many people are visiting the site. If Google is putting its own similar service at the top of its own search page, then you're going to suffer from that. And they're saying that Google is using its might in this search engine world, the cyberspace world, to take advantage to promote itself.
Now, finally, what has Google said in response?
Well, Google says that each particular case does raise slightly different issues. They're kind of saying that they're not choking off competition. They're not trying to hurt their users or partners. It's not the case at all. Google says it always listens carefully. If someone's got a real concern, they try to work out the problem. A lot of it is around the technology, Google's saying that some of these companies might be using some kind of software that's putting them at a disadvantage. It believes its business practices do reflect its commitment to be fair and square in the market, though. These companies are saying Google needs to be neutral. It's an issue which is going to be visited on Capitol Hill. Net neutrality.
Net neutrality. Can Google be neutral? Frankly, advertising other companies that it's in competition with. Russell Padmore, BBC correspondent in London. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, we talk food like we do every Wednesday. How much do those expiration dates on labels really matter? Maybe less than you think. And we'll talk more later this hour about using the smell test, not the read test. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Until tomorrow when he comes back, and of course I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we talk food every Wednesday. Today is Wednesday, but how unsafe are expired foods? We talk with someone who ate only expired foods for 2 weeks as she joins us with her story and the story of her stomach in just a few minutes. Right now, here, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. During congressional hearings today, Toyota's president is expected to take full responsibility for the company's safety recalls. Akio Toyoda is also expected to offer his condolences to the families of four people who died in a Toyota crash allegedly caused by a sticky gas pedal back in August. Moving overseas now, a big story out of Turkey this morning. A court in Turkey has charged seven senior military officers with plotting to overthrow the government there. To get more on the story, we spoke earlier with BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus from London. He told us what accusations those seven military officials were facing.
Well, they are just a few, a handful of a much larger number of military figures who it is alleged have been engaged in efforts to mount some kind of military coup in Turkey. This is essentially, if you like, a kind of constitutional struggle which goes to the rather peculiar role of the military in Turkey, which sees itself as the bastion, the defender of Turkey's secular revolution. And of course now with a mildly Islamist political party in power, the AKP, so it's very much a political a battle of wills.
And do we have a sense that these particular seven officers were in the sights of the government for political reasons, or is there reason to believe they may have been plotters?
I think it's more that, I mean, we don't know what they were doing, but it's more a case of the military and this Islamist party being, if you like, at loggerheads. I think it's interesting, though, because we use this label Islamist. If you go to the AKP's headquarters, like I've been to in Ankara, you find men in sharp suits all packing BlackBerries. It looks just like any other modern political party in Western Europe. So, you know, this is a very interesting and intriguing Turkish political battle, but clearly one that threatens to overturn the calm of Turkish politics that has reigned for some years now.
That was Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC, speaking with us earlier this morning from London.
At the Olympics today, women's bobsled finals are on the agenda. The U.S. is in the running for a medal in that event. They're at 6:15 p.m. Eastern time this evening. The U.S. took a silver yesterday in the Nordic Combined Team Relay. That's a cross-country skiing event. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Hey, that's the Fat Boys, and the Fat Boys means Wednesday, which means the food on the takeaway. Now, as more people are being forced to stretch their food dollar, a question does come to mind. Can I eat that expired soup lingering in the back of the fridge? What about that apple? It's a little soft, but is it okay? Or will I get sick if I eat it? Well, Nadia Arumugam is a food writer whose work has appeared in Slate and The Guardian and The Times of London. And that's not all. She also embarked on a project. Her diet consisted solely of expired food for a whole 2 weeks. Apparently she survived because she's sitting across from me, and she's here to tell us what she ate, what she learned, and how her stomach felt along the way. And I'm also going to ask her how it tasted. And for the science behind the experiment and the science of, frankly, older food, Dr. Ten Labuza is here. He's a food scientist at the University of Minnesota, and he's worked with the Department of Defense on food safety issues. Nadia, I want to start with you. You ate expired food for 2 weeks. Now, you look okay to me. You look healthy. You're not green, at least. Does this mean that expired food, by definition, is safe, or is there a division here? Some is safe, some isn't.
Well, you know, this might be a surprise to you, but expiration dates address the quality and freshness of your food, not safety. So when you eat cookies that have sat around for maybe 6 months too long, they might not be too tasty, but they're not going to make you sick. So in fact, there are no federal regulations that govern expiration dates, apart from infant food and baby formula. Now, you do have a few states that have rules when it comes to dairy products, but mostly almost everything else that you see in the supermarket that has a printed date on it, those are decided purely by manufacturers. So in my experiment, that I decided that I wanted to see how far my human instincts, my basic common sense, was going to take me. Now, let's not forget that food is an organic substance, and nature is going to tell us when it's not right to eat. So, for example, let's say you have a head of broccoli in your fridge. The florets are yellowing, they're getting all mushy, it's feeling very light and wrinkly. That's basically nature's warning signals to you, saying that you need to throw it out. The nutrients are depleting, it's not going to give you any value. On the other hand, let's say you have some prepared broccoli in a pack. Now, if that's a day or two past its use-by date, but it still looks very green, very fresh, the stalks are firm, the florets are tight, again, that's nature telling you that it's perfectly fine for you to cook it up and enjoy it.
So really, it might be more about the sight test and what we've always called the smell test. The smell test is a cliche. Rely on that, you're saying, rather than just what's printed on the label. Well, I want to turn this around on Dr. Libuzza, because you're on the scientific end of this. Dr. Libuzza, I understand you've tried seven-year-old chicken, and this was in a bunker in Washington?
Right. Well, it wasn't in Washington, and it was seven-year-old, but it was a canned chicken.
Ah, okay. But 7 years old nonetheless.
Right.
And you've lived to tell the tale.
Temperature, and so that it tasted just as good as the freshly canned product.
Now, on the other side of this, Dr. Libuzza, there are foods that we've been told never go bad, and I want to run a couple of these by you because it may not be the case with some of them. What about salt? Can salt go bad?
Well, salt, the typical table salt that you use is probably millions of years old, and it doesn't go bad unless it's high humidity. At high humidity above 75%, then the salt will start to cake up. Okay. You'll see a wet surface on it, and it gets stuck together. And people put rice in their salt shaker, and that usually takes care of the problem.
Good point. It's in the ground for millions of years before it gets in a cylindrical shaker, I guess. Now, what about vinegar?
Vinegar has some eggs in it of what we call vinegar eels. They're little organisms, and so after a long time, you can start getting eels in it.
I'm sorry.
They're not going to make you ill.
I'm sorry. You just said eels?
That's what we call them, but they're little worms.
Little worms in the vinegar.
Right.
So you got to watch out for worms if your vinegar is old. That's counterintuitive because vinegar is supposed to be sort of a classical a preservative. Now, finally, what about honey?
Honey can ferment. Yeast can get into it and cause fermentation. The Romans and the Greeks used to, in fact, allow that to happen to create an alcoholic beverage called mead.
Mead, right, like from back in when I used to read Beowulf in high school. Well, Nadia, let me ask you, you seem to be suggesting by saying that expiration dates are put on there by the manufacturer, that this is sort of like my toothbrush when they put a blue strip on there and they say, oh, the blue strip is worn out, get a new toothbrush. Mm-hmm. Toothbrush is perfectly fine. It still works. I use it for, I dare say, 3 years after the blue strip is worn off. Is this basically the same thing on canned food or packaged food?
Yes. You know, I'm essentially saying use the expiration dates as a guide if you like, but ultimately don't rely on them.
Use your nose.
Use what survival skills nature has given us.
Right. We've been dealing with old food since the dawn of time, I
Absolutely.
Suppose. Well, speaking of old food, you've got some with you there. So why don't you go ahead and pass it out? Now, what have you got?
I basically dug around in my fridge last night in my cupboards.
Okay.
And, you know, I have this jar of mayonnaise that I have.
All right. I'm reluctant. Old mayonnaise makes me. All right.
I had this in a sandwich 2 days ago, and I looked at it last night, and I realized that the best of use by date May 09, and okay. I hadn't noticed a single thing. It tastes perfectly good.
Well,
to
you
me.
Know, take toss that mayonnaise
okay,
over here,
here you
or
go.
You can hand it across. Now you're talking to someone, Nadia Celeste. I'm a guy. If I see, first of all, I don't love mayonnaise. I'm taking one for the team here at the Takeaway because I don't love mayonnaise in the first place.
Just stick your finger in it.
But if I, well, it's hey, it's from May 09. Why not? Although you're probably keeping it. You know, if I feel like I'm taking a risk. Okay, well, it tastes fine. Nadia, you know what? The takeaway for me is Mayo 9 for mayonnaise. You've won me over. I suppose it's okay. Thanks for coming in and educating us about old food. Nadia Arumugam is a food writer whose work has appeared in The Slate and Guardian. She had expired food for 2 weeks. And of course, Dr. Ted Libuzza from the Department of Defense has worked at the Department of Defense and the University of Minnesota. Thank you both.
For more details on what to eat and what you should throw away, check out our site. Our producer, Kristen Mines, put some basic guidelines there. It's at the Takeaway.org. And while you're there, there's another bonus. A lot of news outlets have been reported that we've reached the 1,000th American casualty in Afghanistan. It turns out the actual total is lower, but much harder to pin down exactly. Producer Noah King looked at how people got this number wrong. Check it out on our site, thetakeaway.org, and click on blog. Our series, Frustration Nation, continues today, too. Being frustrated? Well, that's one thing. Lots of people say they're frustrated, but do you have a solution? Some of our listeners do.
My name is Cliff. I'm calling from Detroit. I think they should tie the pay to the work done.
Seven words from Cliff in Detroit. Still, pretty good solution there. Give us your fix at 8778-MYTAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And as always, we're taking suggestions for who had a good week and a bad with our friends at The Week magazine. I'd like to suggest either Google or Toyota again. Top up there, not great weeks for them. We're going to look at the week's up and downs on Friday. 8778-MYTAKE. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry, just for one more day. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.